Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Monday, April 10th, 2017. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, Sarah Kennard and Anna Edgerly Moore will tell us about the upcoming travel fair. Ben Huff will be here to highlight the Friends of the Alaska State Museum's upcoming Behind the Scenes Gala. We'll learn about bats, and Alita Buss will be here to preview Tuesday night's Mudrooms. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more. Right here, live and local on a Juneau afternoon, it's currently a beautiful 52 degrees at the Juneau International Airport.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Neil Gorsuch has been sworn in as Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. President Trump's pick for the High Court faced a partisan battle. While some Montana tribes showed their support, the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes endorsed Gorsuch in February, pointing to his knowledge of federal Indian law and Indian issues. The tribe also acknowledged his reputation on issues important to Western states. Gorsuch served as a federal judge in Colorado. In March, U.S. Senate Committee of Indian Affairs Chairman John Hoeven, tribal leaders and representatives of the National Congress of American Indians and the Native American Rights Fund met at the White House to discuss the then-nominee's judicial record, which included tribal sovereignty and religious freedom. It included a case where Gorsuch upheld a Native American prisoner's right to exercise religious freedom and access a prison sweat lodge. An appeals court has sided with the Navajo Nation in a dispute with the U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs over funding for the tribe's judicial branch. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports the ruling means the federal government will pay the tribe nearly $16 million.
The decision by the District of Columbia U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals awards the tribe the full amount it sought in 2013 plus interest. The BIA awarded the Navajo Nation only a small portion of the request, but the tribe argued federal officials missed a deadline to reject it. Under the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act, the request is automatically approved if the BIA doesn't deny it within 90 days. The agency claimed it was allowed more time because of a two-week partial government shutdown. However, the judge said the agency still had ample opportunity. The decision reverses an earlier district court ruling against the tribe. Navajo Vice President Jonathan Nez applauded the judgment and said it holds the BIA accountable for its trust responsibilities to the Navajo Nation. I'm Ryan Heiches in Flagstaff.
After years of requests, administrators at the University of Wyoming have granted Native students an Indian center on campus. As Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, the center will move to a prominent location.
Raynette Tendora is a Northern Arapaho graduate student celebrating the news. She says currently Native students must host ceremonies and tribal speakers in homes off campus or in a small multicultural room on campus. She said one of the reasons Native enrollment is at its lowest at UW right now is because Indigenous students come from supportive communities, and it's hard to find that on a university campus.
I have a high schooler who's 16 years old, and that's part of what he's looking at when he's looking at colleges is what they provide Native American students. And if you look at the research, it shows that having a support system for Native American students is very crucial for retention rates.
American Indian Studies Director Kasky Russell says the center suddenly shifted from a dream to a reality thanks to UW's new president.
When President Nichols came on board, she showed real interest in American Indian issues, American Indian studies, and especially bettering the relationship with the two nations on the reservation.
High Plains American Indian Research Institute Director Judy Antel says the house is perfect for an American Indian center. It even has an east-facing door, a tradition in many cultures.
We need a place where we can cook our food and have our prayers, have our ceremonies, and have our discussions, our conversations together, where we can extend hospitality to our guests when they visit, especially our elders when they come to campus. We need a place where we can host them and make them feel comfortable.
Antel says the hope is to post a welcome sign outside the center in Arapaho and Shoshone, the languages of the state's two tribes. The American Indian Center is slated to open this summer. I'm Melody Edwards in Laramie.
The Bank of Canada unveiled a new $10 note on Friday. It celebrates four Canadians in history, including James Gladstone, the first senator who was First Nation. First Nations leaders were among those at the unveiling ceremony in Ottawa. The bills will be available at financial institutions in June. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by BNSF Railway Company, supporting STEM careers since 1990 as a corporate partner of the American Indian Science and Engineering Society. BNSF STEM scholarships available at aises.org/scholarships.
The Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Touring Department welcomes the Gathering of Nations to Expo New Mexico, April 28th and 29th. Information on services and the Gathering of Nations at siabq.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juneau Afternoon here on Monday, April 10th. It's about 6 minutes past the hour, and joining me now in the studio are folks from Travel Juneau, and we're going to be talking about the upcoming travel fair that's this Saturday at the Jack. Welcome to the show, Sarah Kennard and Anna Edgerly-Moore.
Thank you.
Yeah, nice to have you both here. Sarah, should we start with you? What is Travel Juneau?
Travel Juneau is the destination marketing organization for Juneau, Alaska. We work to promote the visitor industry here in town and help generate hotel bed tax. We have a couple different departments, and part of what I do is membership services.
And it used to be
JCVB. We used to be the Juneau Convention and Visitors Bureau, and we've since rebranded over the last year, so we're pretty excited about that. We have a fresh new look, which is definitely wrapped into the look of the travel fair.
And explain what you are as far as like a nonprofit and what your mission is here in the community.
So we are we're a local private nonprofit. We do receive some city funding, but our goal is to help promote Juneau, Alaska as a prime visitor and meetings destination to folks across the country and across the world.
And that's just a great source of revenue for our city and a way to share it.
It does help promote, bringing in revenue, which then helps float the rest of the economy. So we do definitely try to work with all types of visitors, whether it's the cruise ship passengers, but also those local independent travelers that are coming to us via the ferry, the airport.
Yeah. Okay. Where is your physical location for Travel Juneau?
Technically, our administrative office is over at 800 Glacier Avenue across from the federal building. It's technically, I guess you could call it one of our visitor sites. We also have four visitor sites, which Anna can talk more about as well, too. But those are usually the sites that most people in town associate us with, too.
Okay. Anna, you want to tell us about a few of those sites?
Sure. Like Sarah said, we have the office, which is technically a visitor site, and that's sort of where we handle all of the incoming phone calls throughout the year and provide people with information over the phone. We also have four visitor sites around town. Two are downtown. One is the kiosk by the library, and the other is the cruise ship terminal, which is just a little bit farther down the street. And then we have one in the airport and the ferry terminal as well. The airport is the only one that we man year-round, but the others are going to be opening May 1st.
I suspect it's sort of obvious what a visitor's kiosk does, but kind of outline for our listeners what kind of information they often give.
Sure. We are manned by about 140 volunteers, and they provide information about the local community and businesses and activities that visitors can access in their time in Juneau.
Okay. And maybe we'll talk a little bit more about volunteers here in a minute. But let's also talk about this travel fair that is this Saturday at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center from 12 to 4. Is that right, Sarah?
That's correct.
And what can people expect at this fair?
Well, hopefully everything that you would normally come to expect from a fair. This is going to be the second year that we're doing it downtown at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center. It's a free event that's open to the entire community. We've got a lot of our excellent members that are going to be out there talking about some of their tours and attractions that they offer during the summer. Some are going to be booking discounted tours. We actually have a live DJ from K2, which we're pretty excited about, that'll we'll be spinning some music out in the backside of the Jack, where we're also going to have a couple of our food trucks. We've got Peterson's Pretzels and Forno Rosso joining us, as well as one of our partners, Alaskan Brewing Company. They're going to be out back doing a beer garden. We'll be giving away some free samples so folks can check out some of what they're working on, and then they can also talk to people about everyone's favorite tasting room and how you can bring your friends and family out to check out their facility.
And hopefully it will still be sunny in the 50s. And
we are monitoring that so closely. I have our fingers crossed.
This is great. And tell us again a few of the sort of people that will be there as far as telling folks about resources for when they come to town.
Sure. Well, one of the people that's going to be there is actually it's our title sponsor. Alaska Airlines is going to be there. We're actually going to be giving away two round-trip tickets to folks that are there checking in with a photo and using hashtag JunoFair17. And we are going to be talking about how you can get friends and family up to visit. But we'll also have more charters. We'll have the folks from Icy Strait Point on hand as well. Juno Food Tours is a tasty favorite, and they're going to be there along with some of our other folks that do a lot of their summer seasonal tours.
What would you say surprises people most that they learn at something? You know, learning about Juno and traveling here in Juno and bringing a convention here. What do people?
Well, I think for a lot of local folks that are here, they actually end up realizing that there's actually quite a bit of variety to do. I think when you live here year round, you sort of get into your bubble of what it is that you like to do day in and day out. But when you have somebody maybe that's not as mobile and not as able to get out there and hike, but maybe they do want to get out and experience some of the natural beauty that Juneau has to offer. We've got quite a few different charter fishing and whale watching companies that offer great rates, so that's kind of a neat thing. We also have a variety of different kind of tours that you don't necessarily realize are quite popular with visitors, like the food tours. Those are getting quite a bit bigger with a lot of the attention that some of our great restaurant members are seeing. So that's kind of an exciting newer thing that I think people aren't really expecting to see.
Okay. Going back to the kiosks, Anna, you were saying that that's where most of the volunteers work that volunteer for Travel Juno. You want to tell us more about that?
Sure. We've got all of the sites stocked with brochures and pamphlets, and we also produce our own map, and it just provides sort of the basic sites around town, the historic sites, and points out where the docks are. It's really, we just revamped it a little bit, so it's now up to date with the correct dock locations. And so that's the major thing, and answering any questions that that visitors might have as to directions and, most commonly, where are the restrooms?
Where's the restroom? You don't know that until you need
right,
one.
Exactly.
And do you need more volunteers?
We do. We are always looking for good volunteers. We've got about 140 this year that are going to be active, and if you're interested, we would love to talk to you about it. There is a training process, and they're just starting this week. We have one going on at the same time as Travel Fair, and there's a break in there, so they're encouraged to go and visit Travel Fair as well and talk to the members that won't be presenting directly to them.
Okay, if somebody wants to figure out when those training sessions are, where's the best place to do that?
You can give us a call. My number is 907-586-1740.
Okay, and if people want more information on this Saturday's Travel Fair, where should they go, Sarah?
Probably the best place to check out first would be JunoTravelFair.com. If they need further questions answered, though, via phone, our direct line is 586-1737.
All right, Juno Travel Fair this Saturday, 12 to 4 at the Juno Arts and Culture Center here in the Willoughby Arts District. Sarah Kennard and Anna Edgerly-Moore, thanks for coming on the show. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Join us this Saturday at the Juno Arts and Culture Center.
Thanks, you too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
support comes from Travel Juno, presenting the 2017 Travel Fair on April 15th from 12 to 4 p.m. at the Jack. This family-friendly event features local tourism businesses, food, drink, and more. Information online at junotravelfair.com. Friends of the Alaska State Libraries, Archives, and Museum presents Behind the Scenes, a fundraising gala on April 15th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the State Library, Archives, and Museum, Andrew P. Keshaveroff Building. This event gives you an exclusive look behind the scenes at the APK. Explore the off-limit spaces, see a paper conservatory in action, get an up-close look at Alaska's hidden treasures, and hear what's happening in the state's greatest space. Live music from Tom Loker, appetizers, and a no-host bar. Tickets available at Hearthside Books, The Jack, and JAHC.org.
This is Bird Note. How is it that seabirds have no problem drinking seawater? The salt they take in is absorbed and moves through their bloodstream into a pair of salt glands above their eyes. The densely salty fluid that results is excreted from the nostrils and runs down grooves in the bill. Watch a gull at the coast, and you will see drops of this liquid appear on the tip of its bill. As the drop gets larger, the bird shakes its head to send the salt back to the ocean. A seabird's skull has a pair of grooves for the salt glands right over the eyes. These grooves are especially large in penguins, loons, albatrosses, gulls, and puffins, but other marine birds have them too. But don't confuse drinking with bathing. Some coastal birds prefer to bathe in freshwater and will stop at a river mouth or fly inland to a lake to take their daily bath. They seem to relish the freshwater, but they're quite able to drink from the sea. The writers for Bird Note include Bob Sundstrom, Dennis Paulson, Todd Peterson, Francis Wood, Chris Peterson, and Ellen Blackstone. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
To a Juno afternoon here on Monday, April 10th, 2017. It's almost 20 minutes after the hour on this beautiful afternoon. Joining me now in the studios, Bride Seifert and Ben Huff. They are both on Friends of the Alaska State Museums. And finish the title for me, Bride.
It's the State Library, Archives, and Museum. And we are glad to be here, Scott. Thanks for having us.
All right. So this sounds fun. A behind-the-scenes gala this Saturday.
Yeah, we're super excited. We did it last year when the museum first opened, and we're bringing it back around this year. It's opening up the museum behind the scenes. Of course, we have a no-host bar, and we have appetizers, and we have music, but it's really about sharing the museum and sharing what goes on there on a daily basis, what's going on sort of behind the scenes to bring the exhibitions and the programming and the history to the community. It's an opportunity to sort of get in and see what goes on there on a daily basis that we don't get to see for the rest of the year.
Yeah. Now, I know you both put a lot of work into this organization. Bride, what is it for you about the museum that you are so interested in?
Well, it was just, hey, I like art and Alaskan history. And the more I've gotten to know the people that work there and what actually happens there, the more interested I am in continuing to participate and support the organization. You know, the Juno Travel Fair was just on. It just reminds me of how important community is for this place that we live. And we have so much cool and amazing programming that happens because of the Friends of the State Library, Archives, and Museum. I personally believe that artists should be able to make a living making art. And one of the things that we do is that we can provide stipends for artists to come in and give talks. When the Shakespeare exhibit was here, we had education programming for kids to come in and learn about Shakespeare. And not only that, but we partnered with locals and had people designing Shakespearean costumes for kids. That happens all day, every day. We partner with Combrio and Juno Cabaret to bring music, to bring art, to bring Alaskan history alive and accessible every day of the year.
I like that, how you say to bring the art alive. It's not just a place for artifacts or anything like that. It's actually a community center where things are happening. How about for you, Ben? Why is it important to you?
Yeah, I mean, being an artist, I want to sort of be a part of something that helps, you know, facilitate and celebrate the thing that I love, the thing that I choose to do, right? And the friends, the opportunity to be on the friends and to be sort of part of that process. You know, a museum can be sort of a static place, right? It shouldn't be, but it can be, right? It can be a place that exhibitions come in, exhibitions leave. The friends enable the space to be a dynamic place, right? We have, like Bright said, we have artist talks and we have workshops for kids. Any age has the opportunity to come there and experience and to learn and to have it be part of their community and their world. And this event is sort of taking that a step further and opening up the entire space, right? Everything, you know, front and back of the house.
Okay, tell us about a few of the events or things that people can expect on Saturday.
There's a variety of behind-the-scenes tours. So tour one is sort of, I break it down into the first floor. On the first floor, you get to go back into the labs. There's objects conservation, paper conservation. There's also the carpentry shop. How do you make an exhibit? How do you hang it? How do you build it? What do you cover it with so people don't get their paws on it? You know, these are sort of things that are happening downstairs. We'll also have Anna Ellers. She's a premier weaver in town, and she'll be there inside the Clan House actually talking and demonstrating weaving. That's just not something that's happened in that space ever, and we're super excited about that. Going outside and opening up the doors is something I am really excited about. They haven't let me back there yet, probably because they don't want me to break anything. But on Saturday night, we're all going to be able to go back into the mechanical room. So we are talking about celebrating what happens inside the museum in terms of education, arts, programming. I also want to celebrate this building. If you haven't been there, get over on Saturday night or any time you're able to. We're using seawater to cool and heat this building. It's green built, and it's gorgeous. If you can get there on a sunny day, I don't ever suggest sitting inside in Juneau on a sunny day. But if you happen to, being inside the APK on a sunny day, it's one of the most beautiful places in town.
Yeah. You know, we just last week we had Robert Murray was here, right, the sculptor for Nimbus out front, and he came and did a lecture, and we have the models for that sculpture, and there are a dozen other sculptures in one of the temporary exhibit spaces. And he made a comment at the end, you know, that he's been here several times. This is the fifth or sixth time that he was here to install and then to reinstall and repaint and do a bunch of refurbishment, and made the comment that, you know, he's been to museums all over the world, and he was blown away at what this community was able to accomplish with this space, right? He was here at the beginning. He saw, you know, the ground being broke, and, you know, knew it was going to be a new museum, obviously, but couldn't quite fathom that it was going to be the actual space that it is. I mean, we are so fortunate, and this is the community's museum, right? And this is the opportunity for us all to come together and celebrate that space, right? As a community, this is ours. We made it. We celebrate it. And this is the one time of the year that we do it, right? The one time of the year that we get to celebrate it in this way.
We keep saying celebrate, celebrate. We're not just celebrating the museum. The best thing about this is the archives are going to be open, mm-hmm. the vault. So these are places where all of our important documentation, and we're going to have actual real-time communication from the Princess Sophia going down. We've got serum run telegrams. These are pieces of our Alaskan history that are usually tied up in a vault, off limits. You'll get to see those. And you'll also get to learn from the experts. The museum staff blow me away with their enthusiasm for their job, their knowledge, and their actual joy in sharing that with all of us.
This sounds like a lot of fun. What time does it start on Saturday?
6 o'clock, so you've got plenty of time to ski, run, walk your dog, go to Home Depot, plant your garden, and still get there.
I think the forecast calls for rain by then on Saturday.
Perfect.
So why not go into the museum? Although you said it's beautiful even on a sunny day, too.
It's crazy beautiful on a sunny day. But you can get tickets at Jack. You can get tickets at the Hearthside. And actually, we had originally put on the pricing as $100 and $100 for members and $125 for non-members. And I just talked to Mary Lou Jerby. She's our president. And I said, Mary Lou, I want to make sure that everybody gets a chance to come, and so it's going to be one price from now on. I've got to go over and tell the Jack and Hearthside, but there's not going to be an extra $25 for a non-member. We want to get you inside and get you in experiencing this, and my guess is you'll have such a good time, you'll join the friends anyways.
Okay, and if somebody wants more information, where should they go?
They can go to foslam.org, F-O-S-L-A-M.org. There are posters around town. The folks obviously over at the museum, library, and archives, they have information as well.
We have a Facebook page too, right?
We do, absolutely. Yeah. The museum and the Friends both have a page, and both of them have the posters up with information. Yeah.
And you said it starts at 6 and goes till about when?
About 9 o'clock, and there'll be plenty of food, plenty of beverage available, and great music. So when you do want to take a break from being inside the galleries and just visit with friends, you'll have plenty of time to do that.
Sounds like a lot of fun. It's this Saturday starting at 6, Friends of the Alaska State Library Archives and Museum Behind the Scenes Gala. Thanks for coming on the show, Ben Huff and Brian Seifert. Anything else you'd like to add?
Have a beautiful day.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Scott.
You
too.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 10th of April, 2017. It's the birthday of Anne Lamott, San Francisco, 1954. Parents, civil rights advocates, social justice, atheists. Anne Lamott said, "I always secretly believed that there was a God. I always secretly prayed. I always found these religious kids." She said, "I was very shy and strange looking, so tense that I walked around with my shoulders up to my ears like Richard Nixon. I was very clearly the one who was going to grow up to be a serial killer or keep dozens and dozens of cats. Instead, I got funny." She dropped out of college after a couple of years, decided to become a writer. Her first novel came out in 1980, Hard Laughter, and a couple of others. She was fairly successful, but she was drinking a lot, and one day when she was really hungover, she heard music coming out of a little church in Marin City, California. She went inside to listen to the music. Published her first nonfiction book, 1993, called Operating Instructions, a journal of my son's first year. She'd been sober for a few years. She was in a relationship. She found out she was pregnant, decided to keep the baby. When she told her partner, he decided to leave her. So she wrote about it in the book, her first year as a single mother and her history of substance abuse and her conversion to Christianity. Anne Lamott, whose newest book is Hallelujah Anyway, Rediscovering Mercy. It's the birthday of Paul Theroux, born in Medford, Massachusetts, 1941, author of novels including The Mosquito Coast and travel books, The Great Railway Bazaar being the best known. His most recent book, Deep South, Four Seasons on Back Roads. He spent 2.5 years driving 25,000 miles through Tennessee, Alabama, and North Carolina. Paul Theroux said the difference between travel and tourism is the difference between walking in the hot sun to meet an angry person who's going to insult me and then tell me his amazing story, and lying in the sun sipping a cool drink and reading, say, Death in Venice. The first is more profitable, the second more pleasant. Both are enlightening. Here's a poem for today by Susan Cataldo, Poem for the Family. Before I went to sleep, the soft lamplights from the tenements across the street, still in the night, resembled peace. There's something I forgot to be grateful for, but I'm not uneasy. This poem is enough gratitude for the day. That leaf tapping against the window, enough music for the night. My love's even breathing a lullaby for me. Gentle is the sun's touch as it brushes the earth's revolutions. Fragrant is the moon in February's sky. Stars look down and witness, never judge. The city moves beneath me, out of sight. Oh, let this poem be a planet or a haven, heaven for a poet homeward bound. Rest my son's head upon sweet dreams and contentment. Let me turn out the light to rest. Poem for the Family by Susan Cataldo, from Drenched, Selected Poems, published by Telephone Books and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity, with a 10-minute fit test to calculate baseline scores and training programs with 50 challenging brain games. Learn more at lumosity.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, April 10th, 2017. We're right at the bottom of the hour. And on the show now is Tori Rhodes. She's a Wildlife Diversity Project person for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And we're going to be talking about bats and also a workshop or meeting presentation this Wednesday at the Valley Library. Welcome to the show, Tori.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, nice to have you here. So tell us a little bit about what a wildlife diversity person does.
All right. So within the Department of Fish and Game, there's a bunch of different divisions, and I'm in the Wildlife Conservation Division, and I'm in a very smaller subset that is specifically focused on threatened and endangered diversity programs. So we focus on non-game species, especially those that are threatened, and bats are on that list.
Okay, and you were telling me before the show there's about 7 species in Southeast Alaska?
That's correct, yep. The range on some of them is a little more restricted. There is a bat, the Yuma myotis, that's only found down in Ketchikan, but with the highest range of, from what we currently know, to about Haines, we've got 7 different species and way less in the interior. I think only the little brown bat is up in the interior.
And what's the most popular bat in our area, or most ubiquitous bat in our area?
The one that we see the most would be the little brown here in Juneau. Places, different communities have different proportions of the bats. Sitka is kind of an anomaly because they have silver-haired bats, way more so than they do the little browns, which are the most abundant and ubiquitous elsewhere.
Okay. And you know this, that we have these 7 species, I'm sure for various reasons, but part of it is because of the Citizen Scientist Project, and you're going to be talking about this on Wednesday as well. Tell us about how this works.
Great. So like you said, we have learned a lot about bats. Bats as a whole are understudied, and in Alaska especially so, and we've gathered a lot of data about the populations that we do have here and the specific species and their ranges through this program, which is a citizen science-based based initiative where we have local coordinators in a number of different communities. Currently, in addition to Juneau, we have coordinators in Sitka, Petersburg, Wrangell, and Haines, and we're just about to start the program in Cordova as well, which is really exciting. We used to have it in Gustavus as well, but we discontinued it. So our local coordinators are in charge of kind of facilitating the program at the community level, and we have these driving survey transects where we check out these large kits over to the coordinators, and then they hand out these perfectly contained small little boxes of equipment that allow people to do driving transects and monitor bats for us.
Okay, so I see you brought the machine. It's sitting right there in front of you. Describe that for our listeners, and then when they're actually in their vehicle, how does it work?
Sure. Okay, so what we have here is called an Anabat SD2 bat detector, and how bat detectors work is they have specialized high-frequency microphones that are able to pick up the high sounds that bats make when they're calling and echolocating, because all of our North American bats are microbats which echolocate. And so it has a super-sensitive microphone, and then it also has this mechanism that basically divides the frequency of the bat call by a certain number that allows it and makes it audible to human ears. So then it has a little speaker and you can listen to the bat call that you just heard, but these models also have a way to download the data so that we can upload it in a computer and look at the sonogram, and that it usually enables us to identify the call to species. And so the bat kit contains a detector, a GPS, and then there's a microphone roof mount that people can stick on the top of their car, run the wire through the window, and then they just turn the detector on, turn the GPS on, and drive it 20 miles an hour. They're pretty cool.
just down North Douglas Highway.
Yeah, yeah. And I can turn it on and you'll be able to, we can imitate.
Yeah, let's hear it.
All right. So it's just got a power button. And so it's listening right now. And there are ultrasonic sounds that we aren't able to hear. Like if you rub your fingers together, you can't really hear anything. But if you do it in front of the microphone, that actually produces high-frequency sounds that we can't usually hear, but that's the type of stuff that's picked up by the detectors. Yep, and so they're really easy to use. It has a volume button and a power button and a few other buttons, but you don't really need to mess with them. But you can, yeah, you'll be driving along, and you'll hear other staticky noise, especially from waterfalls and puddles and sometimes insect noise, but you'll definitely hear a bat call if you're able to pick one up, which... we're lucky that we have quite a few bats around, so you'll likely be able to.
About how many citizen scientists do we have here in town right
now? Not a whole lot. We didn't have too many last year, mostly because there wasn't somebody in my position to kind of help drum up support. Over the past couple of years, I think we've had 151 volunteers region-wide, and we've picked up, I think, 1,700 bat calls just from those alone, not with any of our other efforts, just from citizen science efforts. And we've been able to identify about 60% of them to species.
Wow. Okay, so this, is it Wednesday night?
It is, 6 o'clock at the Valley Library, and our coordinator for Juno is Beth Weigel at the Juno Library. She's been kind enough to facilitate the program with us the past couple of years, and she's offered to continue it, which we are thrilled about. So we're going to have a bat detector there, and that's where we're going to have the presentation. And we're also going to have a bat detector kit in the Douglas Fish and Game Office this year, and our program technician, Paul Converse, has kindly volunteered to facilitate that. So we're hoping that people come to the presentation, that they'll learn a little bit about the program. If you've already volunteered, we'll be able to go over results from the past couple of years that we've just now gotten. We've learned so much from all the data that's been collected, not just in Juneau, but around Southeast. So there'll be amazing things that we've learned just in the past couple of months and trainings and, you know, available to answer any questions that you might have. And after that, you can check out a detector from the library or Fish and Game and help us out.
Tori, why are you passionate about studying bats?
Oh, probably because they're so imperiled right now. Bats are an incredibly diverse group of animals, second only to the rodents. There's 1,300 species worldwide. They've got a huge distribution. They're found pretty much every place other than the high circumpolar regions, and they're an incredibly valuable, I don't know if you're going to call it a member, but a species to ecosystems worldwide. They're important pollinators. They're important for pest control. A lot of the foods that we eat wouldn't be possible without bats, like bananas and mangoes, and, I mean, if you're a tequila drinker, agave. And they are just an incredible pest control mechanism. Our little insectivorous bats, our little brown bats, can eat thousands of bugs a night, and it's, you know, cuts down on pesticide use. And they're incredibly important, and they're adorable and very misunderstood and have a bit of a bad reputation. But they're quite cute.
All right, Tori, giving the presentation this Wednesday at the Valley Library at 6 p.m., Become a Citizen Scientist. Help Alaska Department of Fish and Game learn more about our bat population. If somebody wants more info, Tori, where should they go?
We've got a website. It's www.akcitizenscience.net. It has all the information about the not only the Citizen Science Program, but our other bat outreach things that we have going on. If you see bats, we'd love to know about it. White nose syndrome is a big threat to bats. And it was recently discovered last year in Washington, and we're worried about it moving up here. So we want the public to kind of be on the lookout and to be aware of it and to report sick or dead bats. So, yeah, akcitizenscience.net, but you're also welcome to swing by Fish and Game, and you could certainly call me. My work number is 465-8155, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Otherwise, see you 6 p.m. at the Valley Library on Wednesday. Great. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Tori.
Thank you so much.
The Center for Salmon and Society is hosting a salmon policy forum to discuss Alaska's salmon habitat sustainability law. Doors will open at the Rockwell Ballroom at 5:30 p.m. on Tuesday, April 11th, with salmon appetizers and a no-host bar. This free program will begin at 6 p.m. and include speakers of contrasting fields moderated by Fish Factor's Lainey Welch. Join us on April 11th, starting at 5:30 p.m., brought to you by the University of Alaska's Center for Salmon and Society.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, April 10th. It's about 15 minutes until the top of the hour, and we're here to talk about mudrooms now. I have Tom Cosgrove of the Mudrooms Board in the studio, and also Pete Griffin, who's going to be telling a story tomorrow night, 7 p.m. at Northern Light United Church. Welcome to the show, you two.
Thank
you.
Hey,
great to be here.
So nice to have you here. Tom, how long have you been on the board now?
I got involved. I went to the first show and was involved from the second show on. So
it's
number six, and we're just about the end. We got one more show in May, and then this season's a wrap, and then we start again next year and do 9 shows a year. We'll have the first show the next season in September.
Pete, how many times have you told a story? I know you're a professional storyteller otherwise, but how many times have you told a story at this event?
This will be my 3rd time in the 6 years.
Okay. In case we have somebody out there who hasn't been to mudrooms.
You want the rap?
I do.
Elevator speech?
The 101.
Okay, so here it is. Mudrooms is 7 people telling 7 stories, taking 7 minutes apiece. These are your friends and neighbors. Pete notwithstanding, everyone we have are your friends and neighbors who have amazing experiences and who have the desire and courage to stand up in front of a crowd and tell these stories. We raise money for charity, $7 it costs to get in, and that goes straight to a charity. Our charity this month is Polaris House, and so we raise money for charity too.
So as we are saying, you two are both professional storytellers, but as you said, Tom, everybody is welcome to tell a story.
No. Here's one of the things. Trying to build in the fact we don't want, it's an amateur hour is what this is. So we have a minimum of 5 new people each time. So we fill spots, 2 spots with veterans. That's people that have done it before and that feel more confident. But so we are constantly recruiting, constantly. So we always need 5 new people. And, we've had people from all walks in life. We've had from high schoolers to 80-somethings talk about all kinds of subjects, some of it pretty poignant and powerful.
And this subject tomorrow night is smoking.
Smoking.
What kind of smoking? Can mean a lot of different things, right?
Okay, so here we're going to be picking themes later on this month. And that's the hardest thing we do because you want to pick a theme that's broad enough but yet evokes something. And this was one that was on the table. It was the last one decided, and I don't know. There was alcohol involved, and here we go. Here we are.
Pete, what drew you to smoking?
Tom asked me for one thing, and over the years I've inhaled a lot of smoke, and folks can go, woo, but I fought forest fires for many years as a Forest Service employee, and so my story is about one of those forest fires and how it changed the way I look at life.
Okay, interesting. As a professional storyteller, what do you like about this event?
Back in the 1800s, they discovered the first dinosaur tracks, and I think it was in Massachusetts, and that was really something. Stories today are the tracks that we leave behind for history to find, and that is such a neat thing. We tell a story, and that leaves our imprint on history. And as long as that story is told or is known, we exist. And that is such a neat thing.
Absolutely. Metaphorically and literally, because you guys archive all the stories at mudrooms.org. You can go and listen to all of these stories, and they're broadcast here on KTOO as well.
That's correct.
Tom, what do you like about this event?
I like there's a element of serendipity about it. You never know what you're going to get or why people volunteered, and there's a surprise aspect. What I really love about it personally for me is I get to work with the storytellers who choose to get some help. You don't need help. If you're good, you can go ahead, but if you'd like to get some assistance, we offer it. And so I get to participate in that, so I get to see the people grow and develop and actually get something that works and the power in it, because it is empowering. It is absolutely frightening to stand in front of a crowd of 200 people is what we're getting. And so when people succeed, it's an absolutely powerful experience.
Pete, what are some of the things you tell to people about being an effective storyteller?
Well, I think every story has something that happens, and that's the plot, and it happens to the protagonist or the hero while they're doing something. And the thing that happens while they're doing something throws a roadblock in, and that person, that hero, is changed in some way. And that's the key to the story. That's the theme of the story, how that person is changed by what happens to them in the pursuit of this goal. And that's what happens in Lord of the Rings to Frodo and Bilbo Baggins and all those folks. It's kind of the universal concept. That's what makes a story. It is not just something that happens. It's this happened, and here's how I changed.
Okay. And then what about nuts and bolts, Tom? What do you tell people about the actual presentation when they're telling the story? What are some things that they can do to get it across to the audience?
I think it's perspective. So the more powerful stories are first person. This is happening to me. I wrote, I ate, versus speaking as if you're describing yourself doing it. I saw myself. It's the same story, but one is personal, immediate. And I tell people, if this is a powerful experience in your life, remember, put your head back. How did you feel? And if you can get that feeling back, it comes out in the words. People feel it out there. It's amazing, and the story becomes powerful. And when you use first person, it allows that to happen.
And, you know, some of our stories in our lives can take a half an hour to tell. How do you advise someone to whittle that down to 7 minutes?
It's what's the most important thing. A lot of what our stories are little diversions from what actually happened. We fall in love with a phrase. We describe a flower while we're on this life-threatening raft trip or something. Well, no, the most important thing is the raft trip and how I almost lost my life. That's the most important thing, that one thing that you want to get across in your 7 minutes.
Now, that's a hard thing to do, isn't it, Pete?
Yes, it is. Some of us ramble.
Yeah, I mean, that's the nature thing. So having that 7 minutes, it actually forces this discipline. You have to throw everything out except what essentially moves the story forward. So it is. I mean, that's probably one of the biggest battles our storytellers have. And so.
And what about things like humor, details? How do you weigh? I guess it's just the craft of storytelling, the art of storytelling, right?
Oh, anytime you can poke fun at yourself, it's a winner. It is. It is. People will feel a little warmer toward you if you can poke fun at yourself.
And right. I think one of the things we got to stress is that we are all born storytellers. The reason we survived, one of the reasons we survived as Homo sapiens is because we learned through stories. Our ancestors were all about oral tradition. And if your ancestors didn't know what, you know, didn't listen, they would have eaten the wrong berries and you wouldn't be here. So we're programmed for this. And you know, when you give somebody a chance to just express that themselves, it's in them. So it isn't like you have to teach all this stuff. You got to remind people. And they're like, oh, yeah, I get it. It's, you know, it's empowering.
And you learn so much about your fellow community members too, right? Like, why is it you're telling that story about rafting? What is that person communicating to us?
Oh, that's the wonderful thing. Everybody has a story. And if you can draw that out of them, you're doing a very powerful thing. Very powerful thing.
Sounds like fun. I know it's fun. I've been to some. It's tomorrow night, 7. You want? Oh, and we should.
Let's talk about who's here. We're talking about storytelling. Tomorrow we got up Jessica Bogard, Liz Eilers, Laura Zahasky, Adam Berkey, Pete Griffin, of course, Bryn Fluharty, and Jill Carlisle. And so we got 7 people going up. We start at 7 p.m. at Northern Light United Church. We also have music every month. This month is Craig Millard, who will be playing the piano and singing, and he's taken off for Australia next month, so it's one of his final performances. We got next month is our last event, and that's on Wednesday, May 10th, and it's Subsistence and Survival. So I'm sure.
Any openings for that one, or
we're full.
Okay.
And get this, we almost filled just by people with the last name Smith. We got 5 out of 7 Smiths in town. They're going to tell a story. So what is that about? I have no idea.
All right. For more information, people can go to mudrooms.org. Right?
Oh, yeah. That's the other thing. We're making decisions on theme this month. Mudrooms.org. You can send us an email. We are collecting theme ideas.
And if somebody wants to participate, what's the best way to let you know about that?
If they'd like to participate, mudrooms.org, again, it's got a contact sheet. It goes to the email. Or you can contact one of the storyboard members who, if I don't have a list, so I'll miss somebody, but there are many and numerous around town.
Okay. 7 p.m. Tuesday night, Northern Light United Church in the Federal Flats.
11th and B Street.
And how would you describe that to somebody?
It's an A-frame.
It's a big A-frame in the flats, up from the federal building, down from the governor's mansion.
Yeah, it's almost on Gold Creek.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of near Cope Park, right in there.
Yeah.
Really fun.
It is a good spot. It's a church and a community center.
Tom Cosgrove and Pete Griffin, see him tomorrow night, Tuesday, at Mudrooms. You guys, thanks for coming on the show. Anything else you'd like to add?
I think we covered it.
Cool. Thanks, Pete. Guys.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon. Tomorrow I'll be your host again, and we'll get an update on performances by theater at Latitude 58. We'll talk about violence and homelessness. We'll learn about Discovery Southeast's new bookstore venture at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, and Glacier Valley Elementary principal Lucy Potter will spotlight kindergarten registration. It's currently 52 degrees at the Juneau International Airport, and the forecast for tonight calls for mostly clear skies with a low around 31 degrees. Looking to tomorrow, calls for increasing clouds with a high near 51. And on Wednesday, the forecast calls for sunny skies with a high near 52 degrees. Thank you for tuning in to a Juneau Afternoon.